Occasionally the rapid changes in temperature nearly got me into serious trouble. My face, hands, and scalp were subject to those sudden fluctuations in temperature amounting from 30 to 50 degrees, which are not infrequent in Tibet, and since such sudden changes may make the skin crack at any time, they were to me a very real danger. Often the faulty spots had to be repainted immediately, but it was sometimes difficult to find some satisfactory excuse for withdrawing immediately to repaint my face and hands. After our evening meal, consisting of barley meal mixed with buttered tea, meat, and cheese, the family stayed inside their tent. The smell was terrible, but the Tibetans are inured to it. It's a matter of fact. The farther east one travels, the less the sense of smell of people seems to be developed. My host told a few jokes, the point of which I failed to see. Perhaps one needs long training to see the point of Tibetan jokes. He then went on to narrate a pious legend he had heard from a traveling lama. I gathered that it was about a holy man, so holy that he gave away everything, all his money he gave away to the poor, his eyes he gave to the blind, and his wife to someone who wanted her. How very touching. Tibetan legends never glorify strength and power as most Western legends do. They glorify renunciation and deeds of kindness. The family then went to bed. The Tibetan nomads sleep naked in their tents. I, of course, could not do likewise. Before falling asleep, I congratulated myself on having succeeded in keeping out of trouble. Things had gone better than I had expected. On the whole, it had been very easy to hide the fact that I was not a Tibetan. The family had not had the faintest suspicion that I was no Tibetan. I had talked, of course, as little as possible, and about very simple things only, listening dreamily to everything of interest they had to say. Whenever there was a possibility of my getting into trouble by not being able to understand exactly what they had said, I had a fit of holiness and retired to pray. They probably took me for a very strange Tibetan from a distant corner of Tibet who was rather stupid and shy, and had occasional fits of craziness, but, nevertheless, at all times they were friendly, hospitable, and considerate. The next morning I had to run away soon after sunrise. The Tibetans are very fond of decayed meat with worms in it. As meat keeps fresh almost indefinitely in Tibet, they must go to a lot of trouble to get their favorite delicacy. They mix the various organs taken from the body of a slaughtered animal and keep the mixture at a fairly high temperature for several days. The mixture is buried in the ground, and dug out a fortnight later. It is then filled into small delicacy bags which roughly correspond to the chocolate boxes of young ladies in the West. Late in the evening the family had transported their belongings into the tent. The temperature was about freezing point outside and the delicacy bag was frozen. It began to melt soon after sunrise and the smell was such that I had to make a dash for fresh air. My host looked very surprised. It was probably the first time in his life that he had seen a human being inconvenienced by this delicious odor. He probably thought I was fastidious. In some districts of Tibet it is a pleasant pastime of the Tibetans to gather for eating matches. Large quantities of the cheapest kind of food available, usually barley meal, are eaten, and he who manages to eat the largest quantity is proclaimed the winner. The rules regarding the game are very strict, and if one of the participants retires during the match, be it only for a few seconds, he is instantly disqualified. In some districts the population takes some interest in these contests, but I never saw any really wise Tibetans who are capable of independent thinking ever present at one. Some of the participants go into training a few days or weeks before the event by taking food enough for at least 4 or 5 men. They fast only immediately before the match. Sports in a Western sense are practically unknown in most parts of Tibet. Walking at high speeds, however, and running and skating are practiced. Tibetan skates are made of bone, and not metal. I failed to ascertain exactly the quantity eaten by the winner of such a Tibetan eating contest, but another nomad family with whom I stayed 2 days later assured me that one of their friends had eaten like between 10 and 14 pounds at one sitting. In the presence of my hosts and a few friends, a Tibetan told a joke he had heard about overeating. A Tibetan going about quite alone suddenly met a gigantic snake of awe-inspiring appearance, of a kind he had never seen nor heard of before. He took to his heels and from a hiding place tremblingly watched the apparition. The snake attacked various small animals and devoured them with great voraciousness. As the animal went on eating for hours, it grew bigger and bigger until its skin was extended almost to bursting point. At that moment the snake gave a loud hiss and a magician came out of his den and handed to it a little red ball. Hardly had the snake swallowed the ball, when it began to shrink. Its body almost instantly ceased to be dilated, and assumed normal proportions. The magician left a few of his red balls on the ground and the snake started again to devour all the little animals it could get hold of, gradually moving away from the place where the Tibetan was in hiding. How interesting, one thought the Tibetan. If I could get hold of one of those little red balls, I could take it at an eating match after having eaten my fill, and then go on eating, thus winning the contest. When the snake had moved away sufficiently, he quickly ran forward, picked up one of the little red balls and ran home with it as fast as he could. A few days later he hid the ball in his amphrag, breast pocket, while he took part in an eating contest. After having stuffed himself to bursting point with the contents of 30 bowls of tsamba, barley meal, he stealthily took out the ball from his breast pocket and swallowed it. Suddenly his body began to melt down, and it disappeared before the eyes of the astonished audience. Only the 30 bowls of tsamba, barley meal, which he had eaten, remained, dressed up in Tibetan clothes. For the red balls of the magician possessed the magical power to dissolve organic matter, with the remarkable exception of snake's flesh. After hearing this joke, the Tibetan nomads remained silent for a few seconds, and then there came a lusty roar of merriment lasting perhaps a whole minute. The Tibetans are extraordinarily gay people, and have a good laugh whenever they hear a joke or see something unusual. I think if something had turned up to lay bare my disguise, making me suddenly appear before them as a white person, their first reaction would have been boundless merriment at so unfamiliar a sight. With such primitive people the chances of being found out, however, are naturally small. The next day was the fifth I spent in the company of these Tibetan nomads. On this day a little color went off my hair and I stood there with a streak of fair hair. This is probably about the worst thing which may happen to a man traveling in disguise. I had not noticed it myself until my attention was drawn to it by some of the nomads calmly discussing the strange fact that so young a man should already have a streak of white hair. The next day, however, a much more serious thing happened, which forced me to leave the district in a hurry. After partaking of one of the Tibetan meals, which invariably consist of barley meal, buttered tea, cheese and meat, I usually refused the latter. I felt the need to take a little bicarbonate. My traveling pharmacy consisted of a small packet of bicarbonate to counteract the effects of bad food and a little radioactive earth for disinfecting water. I stealthily added a tiny pinch of bicarbonate to the buttered tea. No one had noticed it. When I stirred the liquid with the fingers, as Tibetan etiquette demands, a number of bubbles formed, and the tepid mixture looked as if it was seething. My Tibetan friends appeared greatly frightened. When I put the bowl to my lips there were cries of horror, but I gulped down the liquid before they could snatch it from me. They all stood round me petrified with horror. I felt rather uncomfortable over this fuss about such a simple thing. I failed to understand why on earth they were so terrified. Why did they stare at me like that without saying a word? Had I been found out? Had they suddenly discovered that I was one of those Pelins, white persons, concerning whom they had heard so many nasty things from the priests? Should I try to escape? Many thoughts crossed my mind while they stared at me aghast for a few minutes without a word. After a little while one of them touched my hand and said tremblingly, "Shimaiti, he is not dead yet." "No, he is not dead." "It is a miracle," echoed the others. "I am glad he is not dead," joyously cried a young Tibetan girl who, during my short stay with the family, had showered on me many marks of interest. I stood up. "And he is not even ill," exclaimed a Tibetan boy. He takes poison and it has no effect on him, cried another. Had somebody tried to poison me then? I endeavored to elucidate the mystery. But all their former familiarity with me was gone now. They regarded me as a saint who could swallow poison with impunity. It was some days before I found an explanation of what had happened. To Tibetan eyes, the fizzing of a tepid liquid is conclusive proof that the liquid contains poison. When I had added bicarbonate of soda to the buttered tea, big bubbles were formed in the liquid, and my Tibetan friends had stared at me aghast while I drank the poison because they had expected me to fall down stone dead. This unfortunate incident destroyed the familiarity with which I had been treated by them till then. I became a great saint and the rumor of the miracle began to spread. It was the wisest course for me to disappear from the district as quickly as possible, before the news of the miracle reached the lamas, which would, no doubt, have led to an inquiry and a thorough examination of the holy man. When I came to the tents of other Tibetan nomads 4 or 5 days later, I had covered a distance of about 190 miles, 306 kilometers, in 4 days, although the straight line between the two places was hardly more than 80 or 90. 4 naked Tibetan ladies were seated in the tent and did not seem embarrassed in any way, nor did they make the slightest attempt to cover themselves or dress when a stranger entered. Ordinarily, Tibetan women do not seem to know what shame means. They are not afraid to show themselves as God made them. I have found some exceptions to this rule, however, in the case of expectant mothers. All those who have traveled in countries where women show themselves au naturel, will know that only expectant mothers hide their bodies. It seems as though nature herself had given expectant mothers an instinctive desire to hide in order to prevent sexual intercourse during that period. If anything may be called unnatural, sexual intercourse with pregnant women deserves that name. Tibetan occultists of the advanced type say that it is a veritable crime against the child to come and against humanity. They also say that sexual intercourse with expectant mothers is the real and primary cause of cancer. It creates a latent disposition to cancer in the man, the woman, and the child. Tibetan occultists are, of course, unable to prove this scientifically. Cases of cancer do occur in Tibet, but it seems to be much rarer than in Western countries, where cancer mortality increases from year to year to an alarming degree in spite of hundreds of millions spent on cancer research and the anti-cancer campaign. Tibetan women do not wash, whatever the circumstances. A male Tibetan who washes his body with water would be despised as a weakling, but a Tibetan woman using water for cleaning her body would wash her happiness away, which is much more serious. Usually the body is cleaned with butter or mustard and utensils with sand. The Tibetan nomads do not work much, but they are nevertheless occupied practically all day, since they do everything in very leisurely fashion. They would drive to despair most of our Western efficiency experts if they had a chance of studying them. Kala, kala, go slow, is a standard expression with them. To make butter, for instance, they put milk into bags made of sheepskin. The bags are rolled forward and backward for many hours, until butter is formed. Tibetan butter is incredibly cheap. Often 20 or 40 pounds of butter are hardly sufficient to buy 1 pound of dried vegetables. I always attracted rather embarrassing attention by my inability to consume enormous quantities of butter. The Tibetans take a great deal of butter and then often butter which is many months old. The more horrible it smells, the more they seem to enjoy it. I once watched a Tibetan boy eat at least 1/2 pound of rancid butter at a single meal. The inhabited area drew nearer. There, greater precautions would have to be taken so that I should not be suspected. Nevertheless, I hoped that in view of the fact that the various parts of Tibet are very different in many respects, the masses of the people in the permanently inhabited part would consider my foreign accent and strange Tibetan syntax as being due to my hailing from some remote part of Tibet. As to learned people, priests, and monks, I had made up my mind not to speak to them at all and to pose as a deaf and dumb person and so avoid suspicion on the score of illiteracy. With cordial shouts of Gale Peb, bon voyage, and Gale Yudan Jag, goodbye, literally translated, please make yourself comfortable. I took leave of those nice Tibetan nomads whose kindness and simplicity had greatly impressed me. Chapter 3 Adventures with Brigands. The Tibetan nomads are very leisurely people, but the Tibetan bandits are quick fellows, appearing and disappearing with lightning-like rapidity. The Tibetans call them Jyogpa, which is also the word for quick or rapid. Amongst my strange experiences in Tibet was the tactful warding off of bandits. Robbery is but seldom punished in Tibet. Bandits prey on unprotected travelers practically everywhere, but few of them are what may be called professional robbers. Most of them are merely people whose so-called honest businesses are suffering from temporary depression. If a Tibetan merchant goes bankrupt, for instance, he is not very much upset. It soon becomes known that he has simply become a bandit, and the moment he has robbed long enough to collect sufficient money to enable him again to take up his former honest profession, he will do so. In most parts of Tibet, the bandits are quite good-natured fellows. They never kill their victims unless the latter start the scrap by killing or wounding one of the members of the gang, and if the robbers are unpleasant in some cases, this is due more to their ignorance and childlike curiosity than to actual malice. On one occasion they cut out the lens of my film camera, filled it with water from a salt lake nearby, and rinsed it thoroughly. They then fetched drinking water, filled the camera with it, and tried to drink out of it. When they found that it was no good for any of the purposes which they could attribute to it, they put the lens back in its place and returned the camera to me with thanks. They also took a delight in opening the films in broad daylight and playing with them like so many children enjoying a new toy they have never seen before. Amongst my many encounters with the gentlemen of the Tibetan bandit profession, two were particularly eventful and amusing. One day I came across a large gang of robbers numbering from 20 to 30 tough fellows, most of them wearing talismans round their necks. Talismans destined to bring luck to robbers are often specially consecrated and sold by the lamas. The gang came on rather threateningly. Although they were probably quite good fellows at heart, they felt it necessary to give themselves a warlike appearance in the interests of their profession. They probably thought that I should run away, or at least look terribly frightened. My calm demeanor obviously embarrassed them. An aggressor whose victim does not defend himself, whilst showing no fear whatsoever, so that it is quite obvious that fear is not the reason of his non-resistance, must always feel a little disarmed. He must vaguely feel that a greater force than mere brute resistance stands in the way of his aggression. When they saw that I did not run away, the robbers hesitated a moment as if held back by some invisible barrier. Then a few of the more bellicose fellows, carried away by their business routine, stepped forward to search my belongings. They were visibly taken aback when they found a pair of trousers, usually worn as an undergarment by tantric priests, who are supposed to possess strong magical powers and to rule over many evil spirits. They again hesitated a little, but finally their business routine got the better of them and they continued systematically to search my belongings. The sight of a safety pin greatly puzzled them. "What is this?" they asked. I held my tongue. How on earth could I briefly explain to Tibetan robbers the innumerable uses of this crowning glory of civilization? The safety pin, a real godsend to the lonely traveler. I never saw such a thing before. It may be a magical instrument belonging to a mighty magician, observed one of the brigands. Anything the Tibetans failed to understand is likely to be turned by them into a magical implement. It is perhaps used for hooking evil spirits, hazarded another. And the evil spirit may be there already, hooked, put in a third robber in a faltering voice. Just as they reached my tent and were considering whether they should take it away, there was a sudden gust of wind. This was rather an unusual happening, since the wind seldom blows in the forenoon in Tibet. The blast was quite violent, and it was difficult to keep one's feet. "Leave this magician alone," advised one of the gang. "He will bring misfortune on us," observed another tough brigand. "He has mysterious implements, meaning my safety pins, magician's trousers, and keeps his eyes half closed." "I, of course, always kept my blue eyes half closed while I was in Tibet. I could have dyed them, but continual dyeing is harmful to the eyes. Net S66 I Orgbok if he opens them fully, it may mean disaster, said another brigand in a low voice. There is something queer about this man, said a stately robber, probably the leader of the gang, who had quietly watched proceedings up to that moment, holding himself at a distance like a general conducting operations. After all, he has nothing of value except a tent, a little food, a few coins, and some magical implements. Let us go. And they all went on, not daring to look at me fully. My next encounter with the gentleman of the Tibetan brigand profession was perhaps even more amusing. There were only 6 or 7 of them. They were not mounted, and saw me in the evening coming along quite alone and unprotected. It was a very swampy district and the night falls rapidly at a latitude of 33 degrees. Other cities on that latitude, Dallas-Fort Worth, Texas, USA Middle. San Diego, California, USA Middle. Nagasaki, Japan Middle. Xin, China Middle. Islamabad, Pakistan Middle. Baghdad, Iraq Middle. Beirut, Lebanon Middle. Casablanca, putting to use my knowledge of swampy areas, I escaped, and the brigands spent a few hours roaming about and looking for the place where I was hiding. I had carefully chosen a fairly dry patch of ground, reached by a tortuous approach across a bad swamp, so that in the dark it was impossible for them to locate the place. After continuing their search for quite a long time, and after making sure that I had not left the neighborhood, the robbers decided to wait until daybreak. Continuing their search in the early morning, they located my tent just before sunrise, and one of the robbers, failing to follow my carefully selected tortuous approach to the dry patch of ground, made a shortcut across the swampy ground and was pulled down up to his chest, within a distance of 6 or 8 yards from my tent. He shouted pitifully, while the swamp dragged him down inexorably. His comrades were too far behind to help him, and the last thing in the world he expected was assistance from his prospective victim. Then I threw out my lasso. The poor chap could hardly believe his eyes. A few seconds later he was on dry ground, looking rather helpless and not knowing what to do. In Western countries, the first idea after pulling a man out of a swamp is to make him dry his clothes. Such a thought never occurs to one in Tibet. Even when a Tibetan slips when fording a river in icily cold weather and gets drenched to the skin, he will go on walking in the bitter cold, or will calmly sit down as if nothing had happened. The other brigands were still 100 yards away and had seen the rescue of their comrade. They still stood at a distance, doubting the evidence of their senses. After some hesitation, they cautiously advanced. A few moments later, we were all seated on the ground in two circles. They cooked my breakfast together with their own and, wishing to make a special effort to express their gratitude, they added for me the choicest delicacy one can possibly obtain in Tibet, and which is eaten only on very rare occasions, viz., skutsi, a mixture of leaves formed into balls and having a delicious taste when fried in butter. Gyod Ganayon? Was one of their first questions. From very far, I replied. From the border of Bod. The brigands felt a little uneasy. The farther a man has traveled, the more he is likely to be accompanied by yidags, ghosts. Had they known that I travel at least 10,000 miles every year, they might have jumped up and run away. You do not look and talk like a Tibetan, suddenly said one of the brigands, a very shrewd fellow who, I found later, apparently had traveled a good deal himself and had met many people. Where do you come from? Tibet. His question caused the whole gang to look at me attentively. I have traveled very much, I responded. And even in countries outside Tibet. Outside Tibet. Outside Tibet, echoed the whole gang. It sounded almost as when white people might say, he has been to the moon. I have traveled very much myself, declared the shrewd bandit, who had noticed that there was something un-Tibetan about me, but I have never been outside Tibet. That must be a great adventure, to travel outside Tibet, observed another. Have you visited many countries? Yes, I have. Have you ever been in the country of the Pilin? I have met white people, I answered evasively. I only told the truth when I said that. Is it true that they have barley meal in their heads which shines out through their eyes, making their eyes look so colorless and ugly that Bodhpa would be disgusted in their presence? I never saw barley meal in the heads of white people, I replied truthfully. Two brigands had been talking together in low tones. Obviously they put me down as a braggart who only boasted that he had met white people. If you have traveled so much, said the shrewd bandit, with a slight touch of suspicion in his voice, you must have also met the people in India who have ears like deer. Have you seen them? I asked. No, he answered, but it is a well-known fact that people in India have ears like deer. Being very anxious to confine the conversation to simple matters and to speak as little as possible myself, I changed the topic and, instead of ethnological problems, we soon talked about such simple matters as food, drink, the weather, and the life, in which my knowledge of colloquial Tibetan did not leave me in the lurch so often. We later separated as the best of friends. It is all very nice of you to tell us that you have met white people, observed one of the less polite bandits in parting, but I don't believe a word of it. He was obviously no gentleman. He did not know the art of insulting people nicely. To take away the sting of this unkind remark, another bandit added to the parting present a few feathers of the quetar. These feathers are very useful. If you are taken ill, you put them on your head and they will prevent your seeing ghosts. Most Tibetans see ghosts everywhere. No house, no tent, not even the most barren desert, where no human being would ever dare to settle, is free from them. Ghosts may lurk in the dung left behind by the yaks or establish themselves comfortably in their cooking utensils. Often the bandits themselves are mistaken for ghosts. It may happen that Tibetan nomads are robbed by bandits and after the departure of the brigands the victims may believe that the whole robbery has been an hallucination. It is not until they begin to miss the things taken away by the bandits that they become convinced of the reality of the apparition. On the other hand, however, the Tibetans are just as apt to fall into the opposite extreme and may imagine robbers appearing and disappearing in deserts where no bandits ever put in an appearance. A few days after my above-mentioned adventure with the robbers, I happened to be in a valley when I was taken unawares by one of the many earthquakes which seemed to become more and more frequent in Tibet at present. There was a terrific rumble and huge stones came thundering down on all sides. I had to dodge quite a few stones to save my life, and when the seismic disturbance reached its climax a few minutes later, the earth reeled like a small boat in a gale and it was impossible to stand upright and dodge the stones without jumping about animal fashion on hands and feet. Some Tibetans a few hundred yards away were struck by big stones and apparently killed. When the earthquake was over, I was surprised to see a Tibetan sit near the lifeless bodies of his colleagues without attempting even to find out whether they were actually dead. When I approached him, I saw that he was not hurt at all. He looked rather contented and complacent, like a man watching a beautiful sunrise. There was not the slightest sign of emotion about this man whose comrades had just been killed before his eyes. I touched the bodies on the ground. The men were dead. Your comrades are dead, I observed. Dead, said the complacent fellow. Wait a little. They will stand up presently. But no, I said, they are really dead. Their chests are crushed. They will never rise again. Wait until the ghost leaves me, said the Tibetan. What ghost? I asked. The ghost who produced this hallucination, he answered. It was obvious that he believed the whole calamity to be a mere hallucination brought about by an evil spirit who had appeared to him just before the earthquake had started. So not only robbers, but even an earthquake with its terrific noise is not necessarily real to Tibetan eyes. Like most other calamities, the Tibetans attribute earthquakes, when they do accept their reality, to the wrath of their gods who are irritated by the evil thoughts of human beings and send earthquakes or epidemics to punish the world. I cannot help thinking that the robbers of Tibet are far from being the worst people to defy the wrath of the gods. The bandits in Tibet take away from their victims only the things they can actually use, and nothing else. While civilized people seldom voluntarily put a limit to their selfishness and wait until this limit is drawn by others, Tibetan robbers do seem to keep their selfishness voluntarily within certain bounds. On one occasion I was robbed by bandits at least 100 miles distant from the nearest place where I could obtain food.